Big show midweek, Wednesday, October 23rd. We welcomed a famous college professor to Connecticut today. He has a new book out about freedom of speech. Where do we stand on that? And what effect will the Trump presidency have on freedom of speech in the long term? In the 5 o'clock hour, Bridgeport Republican Chair Michael Garrett joined us. There's a rumor going around that, well, the Republican candidate for mayor, John Rodriguez, may set aside his ballot line and urge Republicans to vote for Marilyn Moore. Any truth to that? We asked Michael Garrett about that.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
It is WICC 600, and this here is Connecticut Today. We're at 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Little palace intrigue going on, really, in the Bridgeport mayor's race, as if we need more of that. But extra layers are always good. Story today, all the rumors about a meeting with the Republican city chair, Michael Garrett, and Marilyn Moore, who's trying to mount a write-in campaign to unseat incumbent mayor Joe Ganim. And joining us right now on short notice, we appreciate it. Mike Garrett's with us. Mike, how are you? How you been?
I'm very well, Paul. Thank you for having me.
That's good. Mike, what's up with all this palace intrigue here, Mike? All we need is the sound effects and everything of the people mumbling in the back. Well, did you have this little sit-down with Marilyn Moore?
That is correct. That part of it is true.
Okay.
It is true, and I have to say I did anticipate what the topic of discussion would be, which was that she would ask for the Republican line, but it never happened.
Now, when you say, Mike, ask for the Republican line, explain that, what technically could be done.
What would have to happen is, see, first of all, it's not my decision. Not my decision. It begins with our candidate, John Rodriguez. John would have to vacate or resign his position on the ballot, which would cause a vacancy. Mm-hmm. At that point, the entire town committee would vote to fill the vacancy. Having said that, at this late date, what would also have to be checked is it now too late at this day? We're getting very close.
So, Mike, is there a statute that says it's got to be X amount or cannot be, you know, this close to an election? Is that something that would have to be checked on?
I would think that there is, simply because the name must be put on the ballot. Now, as it is, if that scenario was to occur, it's too late to put, it would be too late to put Marilyn Moore's name on the absentee ballots. They've already been printed. But there's also the paper ballots that are given to the voter, you know, with the bubble
yeah.
that you fill in. That all has to be done. And so there is logistics involved in the printing of it, and you can't wait till the last day. So, yes, I expect that there is a cutoff date.
This, Mike, is all very interesting, and obviously the Republicans are registered Republicans in the city of Bridgeport and everywhere else for a reason. John Rodriguez, fine gentleman. I've had him in here on the show. We've talked on the phone.
And
very passionate. Very, you can just tell by talking to him how passionate he is about education in the city. So this whole thing is, I guess, Mike, the classic case of. Do we, and not to put words in your mouth, but it seems to be, is this the classic case of do we fight for who we are? Do we maintain who we are? Do we face these long odds? or how important is it to beat who is ever in the office now? I guess that's what you're looking at from your point of view.
Well, what the way that this worked, the way it worked out as time went by, John made it very clear that he wasn't going to step down.
Mm.
Either way, this was already a dead-on-arrival situation. Nonetheless, I can understand why Marilyn would request to be seated on our slate.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand that. I think it would be to her advantage just from the standpoint of visibility. So I understand, I really do understand that she's caught between a rock and a hard place, that's unfortunate.
What kind Well, go ahead. I'll let you finish. Go ahead.
I think I completed my thought.
Yeah. If you did this, and a very hypothetical, you say at this point, obviously, it doesn't look like it, but you did this, what kind of blowback, if any, do you think you would get from the rank and file of the Republican Party, which, as you say, is less than the Democrats, but you still have over 4,000 people in this city registered as Republicans? Have you entertained the thought as to what that might be?
I have. Of course, I also entertained the scenario that would have to occur. And of course, the first thing would be that John would have to be agreeable to vacate his seat.
Mm-hmm.
And right away, as I said before, that was a non-starter.
Sure.
But let's say for hypothetical reasons he did. We venture now into the unknown, and I would expect that our candidate would at that point, or our former candidate, would have to explain that I'm doing this for the greater good of Bridgeport, not for the benefit of a political party.
And let's face it, I mean, your party, and I think you would be, you know, they would be well-served in wanting to do this, your party is going to look for, and when we say something in return, you know, Mike, we're not talking about anything underhanded, but if they were to do something like that, I would assume that they would at least want more representation in if Ms. Moore won as to how the city would be run, operated, and managed.
Those are all considerations that, you know, might become a reality had this gone through,
mm-hmm.
right to fruition. But, you know, we're never going to know, Paul. We're never going to know.
Michael Garrett, the Republican chairman of Bridgeport, with us talking about, the rumor and the story, actually, of a meeting that did take place, a little conversation he had a few days ago with Marilyn Moore, who's running for mayor here in Bridgeport, and talking more about the idea that was floated. Michael says it's likely not going to happen of John Rodriguez, the GOP candidate, stepping aside here and freeing up the ballot line. But then again, Mike Garrett, it doesn't really stop your whoever in Bridgeport wants to vote for whomever, right? It's a free country.
That is correct. John will be on line B, right there in the first position.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the way it's shaking out is Marilyn will be a write-in candidate, and so there's a different protocol with that.
Do you anticipate, Mike, let's take the scenario. I'm not saying, you know, I'm favoring one or the other. Like I said, I just want good governance here.
Yep.
But if Marilyn Moore did win, do you anticipate any sort of a possible, or maybe even if, you know, if Joe Ganim gets reelected, do you anticipate anything more, any more overtures from either camp either Maryland or the mayor, if they were to get elected, to make some overtures to, you know, Republicans. We're kind of all in this together, to, if not elected seats, to get more input from your party over the next 4 years?
I would expect that Marilyn Moore reaching out, as she did with this meeting, mm-hmm. is more likely. I doubt it severely that Joe Ganim will. He never has cooperated with the Bridgeport Republican Party. For instance, there was a zoning board of appeals position that was open, and he had to choose a minority candidate, mm-hmm. Because that's the city charter. And I spoke out against it, but it didn't make any difference. So, that doesn't show me that he wants to be cooperative.
Without getting too specific, because a conversation is a conversation between two people. What else did you discuss with Marilyn as far as the city in general and possible vision for the future? What else came up in conversation?
Well, I mentioned that the way that the city is now planned going forward, it's a plan based on expanding population and expanding housing. And I think that is extremely foolish and will lead to disaster in the future.
In what way? In what way, Mike?
We already, our infrastructure, our physical infrastructure is straining. We certainly do not have the local economy to provide jobs for a larger population. And a lot of that population is a dependent population, because the Democrats consider that a constituency. So as I see it, their main aim is to build the party, not to improve the city. And that's unfortunate, but that's the way I see it. And I express that to Marilyn, and she agreed that there definitely has to be the job situation and the physical infrastructure and better education. All of that has to be addressed.
Mike, no matter who wins on Election Day, or maybe if it's held a little later, who knows what the court will decide about the primary or whatever, but eventually we're going to have an election here, and then 4 years from now, God willing, if Armageddon doesn't happen, if we don't get that killer asteroid somewhere, we're going to have another...
Blow his horn, huh?
What?
If Gabriel doesn't blow
his horn. Yes, yes. That's a great, great old song there. Absolutely. We're going to be here in 4 years, you and I, God willing, and we'll be talking about an election. And what do you think is being done, what should be done, to eliminate again problems that might pop up with the absentee ballots? Does the city have to step up? Does the Secretary of the State have to step up? The State Election Enforcement Commission? I mean, frankly, Mike, I don't care who wins, and I'm saying that in a benevolent way, but the process just has to be cleaned up.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. As you know, Paul, in 2017, an election was overturned twice.
Council, yeah.
For improprieties with absentee ballots. So here we are, only 2 years later, and we're here again. We're here again. Yes, the protocols, the procedures, they all have to change. And here's how I explain it. Can you imagine if you walked into your polling place and some political operative walked in with you as you have your ballot and is trying to convince you to vote a certain way? But that's exactly what's going on with these absentee ballots. When the political operative is in the home with the elderly person. They're trying to influence the way they vote, and they shouldn't even be there. So,
well, yeah, Mike, I mean, there has to be a will to make the change, because the change benefits everybody. You know, I know on the surface some people may say, well, it benefits one or the other, but the bottom line is integrity benefits everyone.
I agree. You just need to convince a certain political party that's the case.
Michael, thank you. Michael Garrett, the Bridgeport Republican chairman. Mike, we'll talk in the future. We appreciate the time on short notice. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. All right, there you go. So he says nothing formal is going to happen. And you know what? We'll try and get a hold of John Rodriguez, too, over the next couple of days. He's made a couple of appearances with us, very passionate guy, and like, you know, Michael said, and, you know, he would have John Rodriguez, the Republican nominee. He won a three-way primary, and he would have to relinquish his ballot line. So not easy to do if you're a candidate. I mean, obviously all the hundreds of hours these people put into it, and they feel they're the person, and they go out and knock on doors and go up and down streets. No, people are serious about this stuff.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
Yeah, we're talking free speech today. The president ruffling a few feathers earlier in the week, yesterday, using the term lynching to talk about what he says is going on with him and the impeachment process, the impeachment inquiry. You can argue that back and forth, but again, it's illustrative of words that we use in society. And the term, the recognized hot-button issue sometimes, of free speech, one of my pet issues. I love talking to people about this. Our next guest will be one of them. Our next guest is the Davidson Kahn Distinguished University Professor of Humanities and Law at FIU, Florida International University. He's also a visiting professor of law at Cardozo University. He's previously taught at the University of Cal Berkeley. Talk about free speech there. Johns Hopkins University, Duke, numerous others. Stanley Fish is the guest, and the new book from Stanley Fish is The First: How to Think About Hate Speech, Campus Speech, Religious Speech, Fake News, Post-Truth, and Donald Trump. Stanley, Paul here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you, sir?
Fine. How are you today, Paul?
I'm very good, Stanley. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Boy, I got to tell you something. It was fortuitous I had you booked today, because I think what's going on now in Washington, the big buzz today at least, no surprise, you know, the president's use of a word in free speech, the word lynching, that I think we're seeing something illustrative today, Stanley, of, as you say, the double-edged sword that free speech can be.
Yes, although there's technically no free speech issue in what Trump said. Mm-hmm. That is, he didn't violate any kind of free speech protocol. He may suffer political consequences, or he may not, but it's really not a free speech issue.
But some people, Stanley, what I mean is they might look at that and say, well, that's a word you just shouldn't use, you know, in certain connotations. I don't know about you, Stanley, but when I hear that, yeah, I understand we do have a few of those words, but I think, you know, you can disagree with me. I think those are few and far between here.
Well, it depends on what you mean by just shouldn't use. If the penalties for uses are social, that is, people won't talk to you, or they drum you out of your club, or they write letters to the editor against you, mm-hmm. Those are penalties that we all risk every time we open our mouths. And so I believe that censorship, in the sense of constraints that we all know about on our speech, is all around us. Of course, that's not First Amendment censorship, mm-hmm. Which can only be exercised by the government.
And Stanley, you pose the question, one of your posits is, what is the First Amendment? How does it really work? Interesting, you ask, is it a principle or a value? Talk a little about that.
Yeah, if the First Amendment is a value, let's do principle first. If mm-hmm. the First Amendment is a principle, then it is almost absolute, because we always say about principles, well, it's the principle of the thing, which means we don't admit exceptions. But if the First Amendment is a value, it's something, freedom of speech is something we value but we don't worship, then there are situations in which freedom of speech might be counterweighed by other values. And so that's a very big distinction. There are free speech ideologues, people who worship free speech, mm-hmm. and there are others who believe that free speech is an important thing, but not the only thing.
One of the places, one of the academic institutions, Stanley Fish, that you were connected to is Cal Berkeley, which, as we well know, was the many people would say the heart, the birthplace of the campus free speech movement in the 60s and 70s, and yet, Stanley, I find it ironic that that is now where free speech is, at least up until a few months ago, not really welcomed from time to time.
Well, I was actually at Berkeley when this all occurred,
mm-hmm.
And so I remember it very well. As for what's happening at Cal Berkeley and other colleges today, students are exerting pressures, which administrators, unfortunately, are bending to. That is, students have a list of attitudes and slogans and topics that they don't believe should be discussed by anyone. They use their numbers and their voice to enforce what I call in this book a virtue regime.
Mm.
Of course, it's not everyone's virtue, it's their virtue. But I blame not students, they are in fact young people. I blame administrators who should know better and should be able to administer their institutions in ways that recognize that education is the business they're in, not pleasing student opinion.
So, Stanley, why do you think then, and you've served at so many universities, you have an impressive resume, why do you think then that so many college administrators, college presidents, provosts, whatever it is, why don't we have enough of them? I know we have a few, but why don't we have enough who say, listen, with all due respect, you come here, we run the place, sit down, bite your lip, and engage these people with provocative questions instead of saying they cannot speak?
Part of the reason is that some administrators equate college and university life with democracy. Now, in general, in democracies, it is the case that all voices are to be equally heard,
mm-hmm.
And no voice should be silenced. But in the university, voices are silenced all the time by instructors, by department chairs, by promotion and tenure committees. I just think that, again, many administrators don't realize that they're not in the democracy business. They're in the education business, and these are not the same things.
Interesting. I like that, the democracy business versus the education business. And Stanley Fish, part of being, I think, a well-educated person, and I was in college late 70s and early 80s, and I tell people, when I was at Boston University, not a small institution, I went to see plenty of people who I didn't necessarily agree with, but I at least had the curiosity, Stanley, to listen to what they were going to say in a controlled environment and then think about it. Is all this virtue signaling and everything we're going on today and the fright about being disturbed, is that in danger? Is intellectual curiosity in danger on the college campus?
Yes, I believe it is. And when you use the phrase controlled environment, that's what the classroom or the academic setting really is. It's an environment in which you turn over ideas, look at them from a variety of angles, and you don't feel the pressure at your back to make an immediate decision that has political or economic consequences. You just, as again, as you said a moment ago, Paul, you have the leisure to think about it. And it's that leisure and the values that it supports that are under threat today in so many colleges and universities.
And, you know, in the society we have, Stanley Fish, it's disturbing, I think, because we have that instant gratification. Oh, it's Twitter. I can put out something in 140 characters. That's how I feel. But again, as you say, after you and I see and hear a speaker, oftentimes, Stanley, the bell doesn't go off. The light doesn't light above our heads until maybe 1, 2, 3 days, 2 weeks, 3 months after we've heard someone speak.
That's even more true of the university or college experience in general. A course that you might have felt was dry or too demanding in a variety of ways will later be recognized by you as the best course you ever had, or as a course that you thought you enjoyed because the instructor was an entertainer has disappeared from your memory altogether.
He's called America. I'm sorry, Stanley. Go ahead.
It's the rigor of that, what we might call contemplative or meditative experience that is being eroded by the events that you have referred to.
The name of the book is The First, How to Think About Hate Speech, Campus Speech, Religious Speech, Fake News, Post-Truth, and Donald Trump. Stanley Fish is the guest, well-known professor, numerous higher education locales. He's referred to by many as America's most famous professor. Stanley, how did you get that nickname? That's quite a nickname there.
Well, I didn't give it to myself. And I suppose if I had waited for a while, maybe Donald Trump would have given me a better one.
Let's talk about Donald Trump. Whether he's removed tomorrow, whether he loses in 2020, whether he serves four more years, what do you think the legacy will be of the Trump presidency on free speech?
Well, one of the legacies of the Trump presidency is to change the way in which political speech is delivered. Most politicians are anxious about what they said yesterday or last week or even last month, and they want to be able to tell a coherent story that ties together their various statements. Trump has no such concern. He practices what I call in the book principled irresponsibility. That is, he is responsible only to what he says at the moment. Mm. And once it's had its effect, he abandons it and goes on to say something else for another effect. His opponents never get this, so they continue to try to make arguments against him or to catch him out in inconsistencies. But that has nothing to do with the success of his efforts to just live in the moment and win the moment. And until his opponents figure that out, which I don't think they will, they're not going to beat him.
You know, Stanley, thank you so much for saying that. You know, I say some of the same thing here on this show and other shows I've done. You're right. Donald Trump doesn't think about yesterday or what's coming up next week or tomorrow. He's a puncher, and Stanley, as you so eloquently just said, you just punched him. He's punching you back in the moment. That's all he thinks about.
That's right, and that goes counter to everyone's idea of what political talk is about. Reasons, arguments, evidence, history, et cetera, et cetera. Trump just does an end run around that, and so far, no one's been able to catch him.
And you know, Stanley, I think what another effect he may have on this, although any other president could go back to it, but you and I, obviously, and millions of other people have seen presidents where the presidential news conference was. That's how the president made a pronouncement. What's he going to say about this? What's he going to say about that? And now with Twitter and the way the president is using it, I know he has thousands of critics, but Stanley, I think that a lot of these critics are also taking notes here and watching how Mr. Trump uses social media.
Yes, and he uses social media brilliantly, whether that is a conscious brilliance or just an instinct that comes from his long career in real estate and business, I don't know. But it's undeniably effective, and all of the people who spend their time criticizing it and lamenting the Trump presidency are only ensuring that there's going to be five more years of it.
You point out in the book also, and we have seen an occasion that's kind of faded down now a little bit, but the residual is still there. I think an issue, an example, Stanley Fish, that'll be taught for years to come in speech classes, ethics, civics, advertising, and the situation with Colin Kaepernick, the former quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. That's a fascinating issue, I think, Stanley, because when that was at its height, I kept having to remind people that, yes, he does have free speech from a constitutional sense, but it's not absolute when you are working for an employer.
Absolutely right. That is, the NFL is not a government entity, although it sometimes acts as if it is. And therefore, as a private association, it has the right to monitor, or at least each owner has the right, to monitor the actions and behavior of employees. It's in the business of making money, drawing audiences. Its value is entertainment. Its value is not free speech. So that even though, as you say, what Kaepernick did was a political gesture, that is, in effect, a form of speech, and he was protected in the sense that no one could stop him from making it, it's also true that no one could stop him from suffering the consequences of having made it, which is what has happened.
And consequently, now Stanley Fish, he is looked at as a pariah by some, an absolute hero by others, and kind of in the middle by a lot of other people.
Yeah, the question is, will any team, perhaps after its third quarterback is put on a concussion protocol, take the risk of hiring? Because it is a risk.
Yeah.
One of the risks is it will take the focus away from football and on that political situation, and no team wants that.
You know, Stanley, I would agree with you to a point. I've discussed that on this show. You're right. The gaggle of press at that first day of practice will be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But you know when everything will be forgotten? Stanley, when he scores his first touchdown, when he throws that first touchdown pass, right? Everybody will say, well, you're all right. I didn't like what you did, but I won my fantasy pool, so you're okay. You know what I mean? It's what America typically does. And America is kind of Stanley Fish, correct? We're a little flighty when it comes to these issues of speech sometime. Hey, does the guy play on our team or not?
That's absolutely right. We always like the speech that agrees with our points of view, and that's why it's so impossible, as I say in the book, to define hate speech. Hate speech is the speech that is loudly announced by your enemy, by someone who's saying things hateful to your ears. There's no universal category of hate speech. It is a category on the wing, always being changed in accordance with particular circumstances.
Stanley Fish, why should someone buy this book? And if they do, what do you hope a reader will get out of it?
I hope that a reader will understand that behind all of the issues handled in each chapter is a continuing meditation by the American people and by American history as to what exactly free speech is, how it works, in what situations. It won't any longer be accepted as just an abstract to which everyone pledges allegiance, but an ongoing process in which we all participate.
Perhaps parents or grandparents may want to buy it for their kids, high school kids or kids going off to college, I would think.
I am, in fact, an equal opportunity seller. I hope everyone buys it.
Name of the book is The First, How to Think About Hate Speech, Campus Speech, Religious Speech, Fake News, Post-Truth, and Donald Trump. They call him America's most famous professor. Stanley Fish. Stanley, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. It was fun.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Stanley. Be good. All right, there you go. The First, How to Think About Hate Speech, Campus Speech, Religious Speech, Fake News, Post-Truth, and Donald Trump. I've never understood hate speech. I mean, I know what it is, because here's the question I always have. If I go up to a person of color and I use the N-word and then I rob them of $100, okay? And let's say I went up to them and I didn't use a racial epithet, but I still robbed them of $100. How does the first crime be worse than the second crime? I still robbed $100 from you. What if I used a racial epithet and then on the second time I went up to you and said, I love you, man. I really do. Give me the $100 or I'm going to kill you. What? Go figure.